Hello and welcome to the Jesuit Border Podcast. This podcast explores the humanitarian response along the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. My name is Brian Strasburger.
And I'm Joe Noya. We're with the Del Camino Jesuit Border Ministries, located in the Diocese of Brownsville, Texas.
This podcast aims to humanize the migrant experience by sharing stories from our ministry and highlighting some of the amazing work that people are doing along the border and throughout the country.
The Jesuit Border Podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post. Let's begin.
Vamos!
In this episode, we're going to talk about hospitality.
We'll be interviewing Archbishop Thomas Wenske from the Archdiocese of Miami, Florida. Stay tuned for that interview. But first, let's share a couple of recent stories when we've been the recipients of hospitality. And maybe we could start with the story of Yorgelis, a migrant from Venezuela.
Yorgelis is a wonderful woman who worked, I should say, because she's now in the United States. Spoiler. She worked as a volunteer and also a migrant herself at the Pumarejo shelter in Matamoros. The Pumarejo shelter is kind of an abandoned hospital that had been shut down and had been given over to the diocese and work in conjunction with the city to be a shelter for migrants, relieving the situation at the river with the big muddy camps and all that stuff to try and bring people in to a better environment.
So yeah, it was a shelter that opened in the middle of August. So it's the most recent shelter that's opened along the border that we've experienced. But they basically just put up big tarps on the outside, kind of surrounding this hospital, and then set up tents underneath the bigger tents for people to locate their families in and to live in. But much like other shelters that we've seen along the border, a shelter like this, it has some staffing. A lot of it is being provided by the Catholic Diocese of Brownsville and its team Catholic Diocese of Matamoros and its team that works with migrants and migrant shelters and helps to run some of those. But it can't run the whole thing just on kind of paid labor. So it relies on the volunteer of a lot of the migrants who are living there.
And Yorgelis was one of those volunteers. Just a wonderful, selfless person. I mean, I think of all the different ways that she was constantly looking out for other people. Like, I don't really remember her ever really asking much for herself, really at all. It was always looking towards someone else, what are their needs and how can I help? Especially I think of women who had been victims of domestic abuse, constantly advocating on their behalf. It's just a generous spirit. And she got her appointment by the Customs and Border Patrol so she can go into the United States. And as a farewell gift to her, she wanted to prepare some food for us. Which was especially a big deal considering that there was, especially at that time, quite a food shortage at that shelter.
That's right. It was just a beautiful offering that she had. Most migrants who are at the border right now are waiting for an appointment with this application, CBP-1. And once you get an appointment, you're able to present at a port of entry and get processed by Border Patrol. And they'll evaluate on a case-by-case basis, but releasing most people for humanitarian parole into the country. And Yorgelis, I mean, it was so generous of her to want to share with us. Unfortunately, it can be the tough thing about timing. The last day that we were going to see her was also a very busy day for us. It was a Sunday, which is one of the 2 days a week where we visit this shelter, Pumarejo in Matamoros, Wednesdays and Sundays. And so she was going to be crossing on Monday. And so Sunday was like, okay, I want to prepare this lunch for you. Can we do it? And it's like, oh gosh, we got 1,000 things going on that day. And actually we were splitting up. Flavio was going to the camp to visit people and celebrate Mass. Joe and I were going to Pumarejo, but we also, both Flavio and myself, had Masses back in Brownsville about midday. So it's like, we got to get back to the bridge and cross the bridge and get to these churches. I don't know if we're going to have time for a nice little lunch after our Mass.
And you certainly don't want to like deny her the opportunity to, I mean, this is her going away. We want to do something for her. We want to give her the chance to show her appreciation and to honor her as well. And she prepared for us tuna fish, crackers, and Pepsi.
You know, if you can't prepare a nice meal for us to sit around and have some fine dining after Mass, doesn't mean she couldn't do anything. And so sure enough, yeah, when we get there before Mass even started, she's got a little tray prepared. And it was a simple meal, but it had, you know, cracked open a bottle of Pepsi and had a little tray that had some Ritz crackers in it, along with a little bowl of tuna. I'm glad, Joe, that you can remember it as tuna, because when we were commenting on it afterwards, you said to me, you know, this chicken's really gone. It's really taking a turn.
I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, but something's wrong with that chicken.
Said, you know, there's nothing wrong with that chicken. It was just tuna, normal tuna. It wasn't bad chicken. It was just normal tuna.
Joe, tuna as advertised.
Joe, it's worth mentioning, is a slightly picky eater, and canned tuna is not usually on his list of
it's
edibles.
It's like one of like a couple things on the list.
Anyway. If I start listing, we'd find it's more than a couple. But
a baker's couple.
But of course, you know, we have to receive this hospitality. I mean, it was so generous. And so we sat down, we started eating some of the tuna on the crackers and enjoying some of the Pepsi while we were kind of getting ready for Mass. And she was so overjoyed by it. I mean, she sat down she stood as we were starting to eat and took some pictures of us, and then gave her camera to someone else and sat down next to us and took some photos with us too. So you could see that this meant a lot to her.
It's just such a beautiful thing, hospitality, because that host-guest dynamic is such a great leveler. She wants to honor us by giving us food. We accept. We receive that honor. And by doing so, we honor her. And so it's just two people, or two parties, if you will, honoring each other. And now you have this kind of this mutuality in a new way there through this guest-host dynamic of hospitality.
It's an important dynamic, because it adds dignity to someone to say, you know, you don't want to create this dynamic where it's like, you know, we're the Jesuits who come and help you, you know? I mean, we're walking into their space. Like, they're the ones who live in this shelter, for example, Pumarejo. They're the ones who care for it every day, who feed one another, who are running the place, you know? We are guests among them. And so to be able to receive that hospitality is such an important thing. Another great story of it that comes to mind recently was when we visited Senda 2, which is one of the shelters we visit in Reynosa, Mexico. And stepped into the kitchen recently on a visit where we were going to celebrate Mass and bring donations. And a migrant from Guerrero in the south of Mexico, Juan Diego, was helping out in the kitchen, and he was preparing something over the grill. And so I just kind of peered over there and approached him and just said hello and wanted to know what it was that he was cooking. He said, oh, he kind of brightened up. He said, okay, yeah, this is, I'm making chalupas. These are a very popular dish in Guerrero, and I should point out that they're not to be confused with the chalupas at Taco Bell. Chalupas at Taco Bell bear almost no resemblance to chalupas from Guerrero, although I personally will say both are delicious.
And Guerrero has their own Baja Blast.
But he was sitting there preparing that, and of course, you know, as I asked him what it was and he was explaining it, then he kind of lit up and he said, oh, would you like one? Well, at that point, I was about to go set up for our Mass right outside the kitchen. And so I said, no, you know, thanks. You know, rather you in the kitchen who are working here have some. And walked out and didn't really think about it again. And so, of course, then it's like, okay, time to set up for Mass. We start setting out our things, connecting the speaker, playing some music. I go around and start to invite people to the Mass, not thinking about these chalupas for another moment. Yeah. We get into the Mass. Mass is beautiful and wonderful. And at the end of the Mass, we go around, we bless people with holy water, we're sprinkling holy water on everybody, and then it's time to kind of pack up our things. And sure enough, that's when Juan Diego emerges from the kitchen with a food container stuffed with chalupas for us.
Which is just also kind of amazing, because it's not like they were preparing chalupas in the kitchen for everyone. This is something that he was taking the time to do in addition to all the other food that he was preparing. All the other things that he was doing for all the people in Senda 2 and for their meals.
That's right. They make meals to serve everyone. It's very basic. It's rice and beans, maybe some vegetables, maybe some chicken if they have it or something like that. Or maybe they make some pasta, just the kind of mass-produced food to serve for the people who are living there. But Juan Diego had this desire to share some of his local culture with the people, the small group of migrants who was working in the kitchen preparing all this food for the shelter in general, and that he would think – to extend that same graciousness, hospitality, kindness to us, you know, a couple of visitors in his space.
Indeed. Yeah. People have a right, in a way, I would think, to show hospitality. I mean, it's we're all stuck in this boat together. We're all on this big blue rock together, you know? So like we do have this right to show hospitality and also to be gracious guests to others.
That's right. You know, Juan Diego coming out and bringing out that food container of chalupas reminded me of the days in the plaza. Listeners of our podcast might remember the stories we told of Claudia, who was a migrant from Honduras, who was working at the plaza to help feed people who were there for the time they were living in Reynosa. And she took to cooking us a meal every time we came. She refused to let us come and just bring the donations that they'd asked for without stopping to sit and join the people of her kitchen that was called Carpa Amarilla because it was underneath a yellow tent, which is what that means in Spanish. And so she would prepare lunch for us every single Tuesday and Thursday we would visit. And I tell you what, over the several months that Claudia was waiting there to get access to relief and protection in the U.S., she never prepared the same meal twice. And you could see just how important it was for her to extend hospitality, that kind of dignified act of hospitality. I'm happy to say now, you know, that was over a year and a half ago. Claudia is in St. Louis. She just sent me some texts because she had one of her court dates following up on immigration court. She's continuing to seek long-term protection in the U.S. And in the meantime, she's got a work visa, and so she's working – or a work permit. So she's working at a pre-packaged sandwich factory, which in so many ways feels appropriate because she was such a food provider for us. Although I gotta say, having picked up some in a rush in a airport, let's say, those prepackaged sandwiches have nothing to compare with the meals that Claudia used to cook in the Plaza of Reynosa. So those are a couple stories that we have from our ministry about hospitality. We're excited to welcome our guest today who's going to share some of his own experiences of hospitality and what it means to enter into someone else's space culturally, linguistically, religiously. And so we're excited to welcome to our episode today Archbishop Thomas Wenske from the Archdiocese of Miami, Florida. Stay tuned for that interview coming up next. We are thrilled to welcome to this podcast episode Archbishop Thomas Wenske of the Archdiocese of Miami, Florida. He was appointed Archbishop there by Pope Benedict XVI back in 2010 after previously serving as a Bishop of the Diocese of Orlando. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you with us. I wonder if you could start off just by talking. I found it curious that you grew up in the greater Miami area, and so then to be a priest of the diocese and to come back later as the Archbishop. How has that experience been for you?
Well, it's been very good because, let me say, the furthest north I ever lived was in Orlando when I was Bishop of Orlando. So I'm very happy to have been able to stay in Florida. I was born in West Palm Beach and raised in the West Palm Beach area. And at that time, West Palm Beach was part of the Diocese of Miami, the Archdiocese of Miami. So when I was ordained a priest in 1976, I was ordained as a priest of the Archdiocese of Miami. Then a few years after ordination, the parish where I was assigned, there was a growing number of Haitians. And so I started learning Haitian Creole, and the Archbishop at the time, Archbishop McCarthy, found out, and then I was assigned full-time to work with the Haitians, which I did for the next 18 years in South Florida. And then I became a bishop in 1997 as auxiliary of Miami, but I spent 6 years as auxiliary bishop in Miami, and at the same time was the Archdiocese and director of Catholic Charities, which enabled me to do outreach also to Cuba during that time. And in the seminary, I learned Spanish. After ordination, I learned Creole. So I speak all the major languages of Miami. I can go to any restaurant in Miami, and if I go in the kitchen, I'll be immediately recognized by the staff.
That's wonderful. I was kind of struck all this about you're learning Spanish, you're learning Creole, and you're learning Spanish in the seminary, you're learning Creole already as an ordained priest. So it seems to be it's these languages are linked so closely to your ministry as a priest. And it seems like your learning Creole was something you took largely of your own initiative. Is that correct?
Well, I learned Creole because there were Haitians in my parish. If they had been from another country, maybe I would have learned a different language. But the need was for Creole. And so I started learning Creole. And it was at the beginning of the Haitian influx into South Florida. And so that was, I guess, I have to see the hand of God in all of this, that providentially I was in the right place at the right time to learn Creole and to be able to serve the Haitian community. Now, you know, many years later, we have, a number of Haitian priests. I think I have 6 or 7 Haitian pastors in the Archdiocese of Miami. I have Haitian seminarians. And so, you know, we've done, we're looking with great confidence for the future, I think. But it wasn't easy. You know, at the time in the 80s, Haitians were not very welcomed by our immigration policy. Not a whole lot has changed because, you know, right now President Biden is still deporting Haitians to Haiti in a country that has no government, that's run by gangs, and it's inconceivable that our United States government would undertake the deportation of Haitian men, women, and children.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you on that. We've been encountering here in the Rio Grande Valley Haitian migrants, especially over the past, I would say, year and a half or so, has been, you know, sometimes national flows go through different areas of our 2,000-mile border. But starting maybe last summer was when more Haitian migrants, at least that we were kind of interacting with. And, you know, I've taken it to my own initiative to do a little Duolingo to learn some Haitian, which I found to be so helpful, you know, just to be able to speak to someone in their own language. You can just see the way they light up because your typical Haitian, you know, many of the migrants that I've met, they speak some Spanish. Maybe they've even lived in the Dominican Republic or they've spent time in Chile. Others I've met have spent time in Brazil and speak Portuguese and Creole and French, none of which serves them on the U.S.-Mexico border, unfortunately.
A lot of them picked up Spanish on their long trek through Mexico as well. So.
Yep, even that too. And so they can manage often very well. But just to hear sometimes just in your native language, to hear someone, you know, greet you with a good morning, good afternoon.
Which is the reason I learned Spanish in the seminary and the reason I learned Creole. You know, I think if we talk about servant leadership, you know, the priest is supposed to be a servant leader. Well, you know, if you're the servant, you speak the language of your bosses, not the other way around, that you want them to speak your language. So if I'm serving the Haitian community or the Hispanic community, I should be able to speak in their language. And again, we say, you know, if you ask any little kid what the church is, and, you know, the kid was at least would have had some rudimentary catechesis, he might answer the church is God's house. And and that's true, you know, if the church is God's house, then you know, to make somebody feel at home in God's house, you have to speak the mother's tongue.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that idea of what church is, I think, is something that comes through hearing about your background as far as languages goes, because you're someone as a representative of the church, you are representing at least the church hierarchy to these people. You are someone who is welcoming them with open arms by speaking their language. So there's that receptive element. And there's also an element of moving out forward to them, because you have to take the steps to learn their languages. And so there's this coming and going element, this receiving and advancing element of church.
My father was born in Poland. He immigrated to the United States as a child. And so being first generation American, a son of a Polish immigrant, gave me some empathy to the newcomers, whether they were Hispanic or Asian. And again, I grew up in Florida. We were far removed from the experience of national churches, of ethnic parishes. But I remember once or twice a year, my parents would drive from Lake Worth, where we lived, 60, 65 miles to the south to Miami to attend the Polish Mass. Now, the Mass was in Latin back then. But the songs and the homily were in, were in Polish, and that had a great effect on me as well, even though I did not understand the Polish as well as my parents did. But, you know, I felt very Polish, and if you're Polish, you would feel very Catholic too. So I think, you know, the idea of, faith has to become a culture, and otherwise it just becomes a veneer that's imposed on something. So, you know, if we don't, speak the gospel within the culture and the idiom of the people we wish to evangelize, then the evangelization will not really take root. So, I think, we have to have that linguistic proficiency, but also not only linguistic proficiency, but some cultural sensitivity in order to have an effective ministry among people that are from different countries or maybe look different than you. I remember when I was in the seminary, I came across an article in a magazine, one of these theological magazines, and it was a missionary priest talking about his time in Africa. And he said that, as a baptized Catholic, he was a child of God, and so, he was a member of the family. But because he was a missionary, he had to consider himself as a visitor in his own father's house, And as a visitor to his own father's house, if you come as a guest, if you're a guest in somebody's house, you don't go and open the refrigerator without being invited. You don't rearrange the furniture without the host knowing it. And so you have to have a certain decorum as a guest in the father's house. It's your house because you're a son of the father too. But as a missionary, you have to have that other perspective that you're a guest and you have to, you have to comport yourself in that manner. I always tell, young pastors that when they go to a new parish, I say, remember this story. And before you, rearrange the furniture in the sanctuary, remember this story, because if you don't, you're going to get yourself into trouble, because they go, like bulls in China shop, rearrange the furniture, and they don't realize that, that 80-year-old lady that's sitting in the first pew, she probably, put that, spend her money to put that altar cloth on that table.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You don't know that, then you make changes and, you offend people's sensitivities. So, as a missionary aspect means a guest in the father's house. And here I am, a missionary in my own backyard. I was born in Florida, grew up in Florida, but I'm working with people that have come from other places. But in their context, I'm still, in their father's house, and I have to comport myself accordingly.
I think that's a beautiful image, thinking of missionary work is not just like you go to travel to a different country necessarily, because here in the United States, I mean, we're a country of immigrants. We have immigrant communities all over. And so do we impose a quote unquote American culture upon members of our church and faith community, regardless of their country of origin? Or how do we accept, celebrate, honor the traditions, the cultures that they bring with them and the ways of celebrating?
The Acts of the Apostles gives us a pattern or a model to follow. If you read the Acts of the Apostles, you remember the controversy between the Hellenizers and the Judaizers. St. Paul had to confront Peter because St. Paul was saying these Gentiles that are becoming Christians don't have to become Jews. They don't have to become Jewish, they don't have to follow Jewish law, because it's Jesus that saves us, not the law. And so that controversy was settled in Paul's favor by the first council of the church, saying that, the only thing that Jesus asks of us to become a Christian, to become his followers, is to change our hearts. He doesn't ask us to change our culture. He doesn't ask us to change our language. He doesn't ask us to change the color of our skin, if we could. He just asks us to change our heart. And so that's the only imposition that we really should make or it's not even an invitation, it's an invitation that we make to people, is to change their hearts in order to become a follower of Jesus Christ.
Shortly after becoming auxiliary bishop in Miami in the late 90s, you were named the head of the U.S. Bishops Committee on Migration. And one of the great products of your time serving on that committee, I know you continue to serve on the committee, but maybe when you were leading the committee, was writing that joint document, Strangers No Longer, Together on a Journey of Hope, along with your counterparts, the bishops in Mexico. I wonder if you could share a little bit about kind of the origin of that and what it was like to write that joint pastoral letter.
Well, it was really an exercise in collegiality, if you will, because the Committee on Migration on the American side met frequently with the committee on the Mexican, our counterparts on the Mexican Episcopal Conference, and sometimes we were writing and translating the sections of it at the same time, and the document, I think, has stood the test of time as far as an exposition of Catholic social teaching on the area of migration. It's unfortunate that it's over 20 years ago that we wrote that document, and at that time we were calling for migration reform, and that has still eluded us here in the United States. And I remember when Vicente Fox was president of Mexico, he came to the United States and addressed a joint session of Congress, and George Bush was president, and both of them were very positive on immigration reform. And a couple days after that address, I was meeting with Bishop DiMarzio, who's also a former chair of this committee on migration and a very renowned expert on immigration. We both went to see the head of INS at the time, and he said, "Oh, we'll get immigration reform done in this session." So I left his office. We left his office very, very happy. Went to the airport. Then D.C. got on the plane, came to Miami. The next day, I was driving to my office, and 9/11 happened. And wow. 9/11 pushed that off the agenda. And I think, you know, 9/11, since 9/11, America has been in a bad mood, and we haven't really gotten over it. You know, and so that bad mood is expressing itself in many, many different ways. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, hate around the issue of immigration. But I would say that most Americans are fair-minded, and most Americans would understand that we have to have an immigration reform. I think, you know, we know that the immigration system is broken. People on the left and the right will agree on it. That is broken. We might disagree on what the solutions might be, but as church, we always say that, you know, we agree that immigration is problematic, but the immigrants themselves are not problems. You know, this broken system is the problem, not the immigrants. So we have to fix that broken system and not demonize the immigrants. You know, sometimes they depict them as lawbreakers. And I say, they're not breaking the law. The law is breaking them. The law is breaking them.
You're talking about, in many ways, this reshaping conceptions that we have and correcting misconceptions, and basically to the effect of humanizing these migrants and showing the elements that we have in common. So this question I have of talking about things we have in common, we do kind of have a common destiny as humans, as children of God.
And we're all made in the image and likeness of God.
Exactly.
And in that sense, we cannot allow ourselves to define someone made in the image and likeness of God as a problem. You know, that's when we offend human dignity, when we look at a human being and define them as a problem. You know, and so from the perspective of Catholic social teaching, no man, no human being is a problem. That's why we say there's no such thing as a problem pregnancy. Only a child that should be welcomed in life and protected by law. That's why that elderly person is not a problem. The handicapped are not problems. They have gifts to give. The immigrant might be a stranger, but as he or she should be a stranger that should be embraced as a brother or sister.
Humanizing migrants is such an important part, I think, of painting the picture better. You know, too often all we get bombarded with is statistics or snapshots or whatever. And so it just loses sight of the real lived experience of so many men, women, and children. I wonder if you have any personal experience, either maybe with the Haitian community or with the immigrant community there in Miami, of some family or someone you knew that touched and shaped your heart and shaped your own openness to the migrant experience?
Well, the migrant experience with the Haitians, I have, you know, volumes of experiences for 18 years working with the Haitians. But, you know, I can remember one time, you know, somebody knocking on my door. I was a cab driver, a Haitian cab driver. And he says, I got two people in my cab. And I picked them up on Miami Beach. And they had a paper in their clothes, but it got wet. And so they don't know who they can call, their relative. So this cab driver picked up somebody that was dropped off on the beach. And so I said, okay, bring it to me. And at the same time in my school, adjacent to my rectory, I had a English ESL classes. So I had about 400 or 500 people learning English every night. So I said, come on, walk over. These people, their clothes are still damp from the ocean. So, and that's all they had on them, the clothes on their back. So I went into the classrooms and I said, where are you from? And they tell me a place in Haiti. So I went to class and I said, anybody here from this place? Nobody. Next class. Anybody here from this place? So somebody raises their hand. I said, okay, take these two people home with you. And they did. Okay. The great thing there was the hospitality shown by these people. Here are two people that come from the same village or the same area that you come from. Take care of them. These people didn't have much. They were trying to learn English to survive themselves, but they took it in. You know, the generosity of the poor always overwhelms or shames us who are better off. So, in my experience with the Haitians, many times I would, visit, minister to them when they were detained at the Chromam detention camp. Later, when they were released, they were coming to my churches. Then they, after maybe a decade, they bought a home. They asked me to come to the house and bless the home. And their kids are going off to universities and coming back as lawyers and doctors, et cetera. So, they came looking for opportunities and were willing to sacrifice to achieve their dreams. And they have, for the most part, they have. So that's the other thing about immigrants, I think, in this sense. They probably, believe in the American dream and they recognize the opportunities offered to them here in this country more than most native-born Americans at this time.
The hospitality of these other Haitians to just take these people, for all we know, total strangers, into their home is something. It speaks of the holiness of hospitality, and the whole context surrounding that is the fact that these people coming in and you helping them out.
That's what we're called to do too, because we have to be hospitable to total strangers who are like that man that fell among robbers, and we have to be like the Good Samaritan that took care of the total stranger and showed him mercy and compassion.
One little question kind of related to that. So many images of heaven out there of the banquet of being welcomed. And of course other images as well. I'm curious, is there a particular image of heaven that speaks especially to you, that you find yourself moved by?
Well, I think, the sense of communion and the Haitian liturgies are very lively and very participatory. They sing a lot and you can almost taste the glory of God as they sing glory to God. And so in that sense, the prayer, the Eucharist, is supposed to be a foretaste of heaven anyway. And as you participate in these, in their celebration of the Mass, you do have a glimpse of what heaven could be like.
The image of Haitians gathered together in song and prayer, that it strikes a chord with me too, because I still remember when we first started having Haitian migrants at one of the masses that we celebrated in a migrant shelter in Reynosa, Mexico. The first time that Soradith, one of the Daughters of Charity, Mexican Daughter of Charity that runs a shelter, invited one of them to come forward and sing during communion. Now, we're presiding at this Mass all in Spanish. Predominantly, the migrant population there is Spanish-speaking, but there is a Haitian population, and they're joining in with the Mass, and they know when to sit and stand and how to participate, but everything's being conducted in Spanish. Well, all of a sudden, this first time that Sorority invited a Haitian migrant to come forward, and this young man, he just started singing in Creole a liturgical hymn, and every Haitian that was there in the congregation stood up and joined in harmonious song. And it brought tears to my eyes. It brings tears to my eyes even just thinking about it now, just the beauty of it and the way, again, language, again, culture, how it can bring us to life, because that's what it did. It turned all these kind of blank faces, participating somewhat passively in the liturgy, all of a sudden took active ownership of it. Just beautiful images. And so, you know, we continue to do our ministry with Haitian migrants as best we can. But I wish we had the same talent and skill that you have in terms of your Creole language. So we're just wondering when we can start doing maybe some weekly meetings for instructions to improve our own Creole.
I have a little, a booklet that I made of prayers in Creole, Catholic prayers in Creole. And I'll try to send you a box of 400 of those that you could pass out to the Haitians.
And that'd be fantastic. I tell you what, we rarely get a hardcore takeaway from one of these interviews, but we're going to follow up with you on that, because I think that would be really helpful and really meaningful to migrants.
A game changer.
Very good.
But most of all, we want to thank you, Archbishop Wenske, for taking time to be with us today, for sharing from your rich experience of pastoral ministry, of servant leadership, and of advocacy on behalf of migrants. Thank you for your continued work in ministry, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. God bless you all.
Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. We're grateful to Archbishop Wenske for joining us.
Remember to subscribe to this podcast to hear more about the U.S.-Mexico border from a Catholic perspective. You can visit our website at delcamino.org.
If you're curious about Jesuit life or know someone who is, visit beajesuit.org to learn more about a religious vocation to the Society of Jesus.
This podcast is edited and produced by the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the U.S. and hosted by the Jesuit Post.
We'll see you next time on the Jesuit Border Podcast.
Que Dios los bendiga.